As the sun is setting here in lovely Hollywood, a crowd is gathering at Directors Guild of Hollywood. There are the year's most famous film, 1957, the premiere of Peyton Place, starring Lana Turner as Constance McKenzie and Diane Varsi as her daughter Allison. The stars are arriving now. Mark Robson, the director. He has just came with Lee Phillips, who plays Michael Rossi, also joining us, the glamorous Betty Field, escorted by her husband, Edwin Lucas. And close behind is Leon Ames, also followed by Lauren Green. Finally arriving, the stars dwindle, but Mrs. Lana Turner makes her fashionably late appearance, and on her arm, her daughter, teen Cheryl Crane. Peyton Place is the newest film adapted from the book with the same name. It promises to leave the audience talking and the stars more popular than ever.
Hey, Darlene.
Hey.
So, I recently read the biography of a movie star from Hollywood's golden age. And I know you love history, but have you done much research or reading about that time period in history?
Not a whole lot.
Okay. Well, I would say it's around the 1920s to the 1960s, when the big movie studios like MGM, Warner Brothers, and all of those, RKO, they were changing the entertainment industry. Churning out massive movie stars. And in turn, those movie stars were making them a lot of money.
Okay.
So it really was a golden time for the movie studios. But there is definitely a darker side to that, as always. Now, I love black and white movies. Do you ever watch any?
I do.
Okay. Yes. My husband, when we first started dating, he got me to watching black and white movies. And that's when I developed my celebrity crush on Cary Grant.
Oh.
Yeah. Love him.
He is handsome.
Yeah. So when I started reading this biography, I was so fascinated by it. And so that brings me to the story that I'm going to share today. So this is about Lana Turner. Have you heard of her?
No.
Okay.
I feel like I have, but...
I tell more of this, you might start recognizing, oh, yeah, I know who she is.
Okay.
She starred in, well, she appeared in well over 50 movies.
Okay.
And she actually starred in many of those. But her personal life had just as much turmoil, conflict, glamour, twists and turns as any film she was in. And so most of my information today came from her biography. The legend, the lady, the truth, Lana. And I also researched using newspapers.com, murderpedia.com, lana-turner.com, cheatsheet.com, and an article by Mark Gribben in truetv.com. So let's go back to the beginning for her. Lana Turner was born Julia Jean Turner on February the 8th, 1921. Her family moved to San Francisco when she was around 6 years old, and shortly after that, her parents separated. Now, her father was a war hero from the First World War, but now that they're in San Francisco, he is working as a dock worker. But he also likes to gamble, and he's actually really good at gambling. He wins a lot. So one evening, he's at a craps game, and he wins pretty big. Julia Jean is around 9 years old now, and he had told her that he was going to buy her a bicycle. So when he wins that night, he tells, you know, his friends and his fellow players, I'm going to buy my daughter a bicycle with this money. But he does not make it out of that craps game. He actually was killed at the craps game, and his body was moved. It was found murdered the next morning. And cops say that the money that he had won was not found on him, and he had been hit. There was a blow to his eye. It caused a cerebral hemorrhage, and of course, the money was gone.
Wow, it's kind of rare for you to hear they were really good at gambling,
right? Exactly.
But that's really sad for her. So she probably idolized him.
Yeah, I'm sure she did. And she does speak well of her dad in her book. The cops actually said they knew who was responsible for his murder. But then she goes on to write that his murder was still never solved. Mm-hmm. Now, I've probably made you think that this story is about that murder. But right. But it's actually not. That was a little bait and switch. I'm sorry.
Okay.
That was just to show that's just one instance in Lana's life that makes her biography read like a movie script. So she starts out, her dad's murdered when she's a very young age. So after that, she and her mom eventually end up moving to L.A. And this is during the Great Depression.
Okay.
So money was tight. And at this point, she's going by her nickname, Judy, instead of Julia Jean. And one day, Judy, she skips class. And she goes across the street to a soda fountain to get a Coke. And while she's there, she's approached by a man named Mr. Wilkerson. And he asks her, would you like to be in movies?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And her reply is, I don't know. I'll have to ask my mother.
Oh.
Isn't that sweet?
Yes.
So she's just a young teen at the time. What happens next is history, as they say. So she and her mother, they do go see Mr. Wilkerson, and he refers her to an agent named Zeppo Marx, the Zeppo Marx of the Marx Brothers.
Oh,
you may
okay.
have heard of him. Yeah.
Yes.
And then he finds a few other people, some other agents, and eventually she is, set up with the right person.
Right.
She meets a movie director. And actually, let me back up and say this. Zeppo Marx, when he meets her, he asks her, how old are you? And she says, I'm 15. And he says, no, you're not. As far as this industry goes, from now on, you're 18.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, was this during the Depression?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wow. What a lucky break.
Yeah. This was like the mid-30s.
Okay. Right. So that was probably life-changing for
Oh, I'm sure. Them. And she immediately, when she got her first movie part, she went home and told her mom, you're never going to have to work again.
Oh,
and
I love that.
And her mom never did have to work again.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So she gets her first part in a film. And her director is Marvin Leroy. And so he's telling her, you need a stage name. And so they start going through, the letters of the alphabet. They get to the L's. And she suggests Lana. And he's like, Lana Turner, that's it. That's who you're going to be. And she does say that she does not, in her mind, it's pronounced Lana. She does not like it being Lana.
Okay.
With the A flat. I actually called her Lana, and my husband was very quick to correct me. He said, oh, no, that's Lana. He knew Lana Turner. So, Lana. So, her first film was They Won't Forget. And Leroy, he cast her in that film. Now, again, remember, she's 15.
Right.
But her part, she was supposed to walk down the street in a tight-fitting sweater. And that drew a lot of attention. Mm. And she quickly became known as a sex symbol.
Okay.
And that's why he said, no, you're not. You're 18 in this business.
Gotcha.
I think even then they knew that was not really
appropriate.
Not appropriate. And that quickly, and she actually becomes known as the sweater girl.
Oh,
she was referred to that for years after that. Yeah.
So that was a popular scene.
Yeah. So now let me back up and say this too. She says that was her first movie. It's actually been said that prior to that, she was cast as an uncredited extra in the 1937 film A Star Is Born.
Oh.
She has always denied that. But a credible source that had a part in casting during that time has confirmed that she was in that.
Oh, okay.
So for whatever reason, she doesn't want to acknowledge
She's
that one
proud
first.
Of that. Okay.
Maybe it's because she wasn't credited in that film. But she does become a sex symbol, and she usually plays parts that show her in that light.
Okay.
So she quickly gets another movie right after that, and she starts growing in popularity. And like I said, then the money starts coming in a little better, and her mom's not having to work. Things are going kind of well. But she's young, and her personal life starts to get very tumultuous. Just reading her biography, you quickly get the sense that right off the bat that she does not make the best decisions. She actually seems to make the same bad decisions over and over quite a bit.
Well, she's young.
She's very young.
And now, you know, you're adding wealth and popularity, and sometimes that can be a, you know, bad combination.
That's right. And that's and because she had never been in that, she's thrown into that
right
very suddenly. So, yeah, you just nailed it when you said that all of those things come together. So here's a quick rundown of what I'm talking about with her. Over the course of her lifetime, Lana marries 8 times.
Oh, my goodness.
7 men, because one of the husbands, she actually married him twice. The first marriage is when she's 19 years old. She marries band leader Artie Shaw. And they actually had not even been dating. She had been dating someone else.
Oh, wow.
They were having a little bit of issues, and he stood her up one night, so to speak, or canceled on her. And Artie asked her out. They go to dinner. He starts talking about marriage. That actually sounds really good to her. And so they jet off to Vegas and get married.
Oh, my goodness.
She was 19 at this point. And so, yeah. So predictably, that marriage doesn't last very long.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. But it does end in a pregnancy. And she says that she was forced to abort that pregnancy. However, when I read more of the book, it wasn't like she was not physically forced to do it. She made the choice based on her career. She didn't want to lose her career.
Okay.
So
that's not really forced.
She wasn't forced, but she did make it sound in the book like she was. So a couple few years later, she marries a man named Steve Crane. And it's not long before she has to get that marriage annulled because she finds out he's not actually legally divorced.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. He was only separated from his wife. During that time, she finds out she's pregnant again. And so she's just, you know, she's mad because he's still married, but he finally gets his divorce to come through and they marry a second time. So she married Steve Crane twice. And they actually end up having a little girl named Cheryl Crane. And unfortunately, the marriage doesn't last long after that. And so she's divorced for the second time. During this time, she starts an affair with another man who is still legally married.
Oh.
So you can see she's got a little pattern here. I think she doesn't mind just dating somebody if they're separated at all. She becomes pregnant by him as well, and she wants his wife to give him a divorce so they can marry. But his wife refuses. She ends up aborting that second child.
Mm.
But she still, in her young mind, thinks that he and his wife will get divorced and they'll get married and have more kids and live happily ever after.
That's their heart.
I know, because of course that doesn't happen. He does get divorced from his wife eventually, but he doesn't marry Lana. He's already moved on to somebody else.
Wow.
Yeah. She meets and marries a third husband. And she actually has, sadly, she has 2 stillborn children from this marriage. She has an Rh factor, blood factor. You probably know what that is.
My sister has that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it made her have difficulty in carrying pregnancies to term anyway.
Okay.
And so she had 2 children that were stillborn during this time. Mm. Yeah. And so you can see that it caused her to go through a really dark period.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Because of those losses, the ending of marriages, she attempts suicide.
Okay.
One of her friends finds her, and they get her some help. She had slit her wrist. And she realizes that's not something she wants to ever do again, promises that she won't. But, you know, you can just tell she's kind of, you know, spiraling downward.
Yeah.
And it's just an accumulation of a lot of things going on in her life. Her next marriage, number 4, is to Lex Barker. Now, you probably don't remember his name, but he played Tarzan.
Oh, okay.
Tarzan in the movies. That marriage does last about 4 years. And they lost a child as well due to the Rh blood factor. And, you know, we talk about how Lana said she always wanted children, lots of children more than anything. But when you read about her life decisions, she hardly spent any time with the one child she did have. She was always, if she wasn't filming a movie, she was off with her newest man, going places and vacationing and leaving her child with either her mom or a nanny.
So it was more the idea of having a child.
I think so.
And, you know, the idea of having a family more than mm-hmm. having the child, because she had a child.
Right. Maybe the security she was looking for.
Right.
Yeah. But that unfortunately did take its toll. And now Cheryl is getting rebellious and it's, you know, they're having some problems at home.
I can see that.
So after the end of Lana's fourth marriage to Lex Barker, Lana's starting to work on another movie, The Lady Takes a Flyer, in 1957. She gets a phone call, a person that leaves a message for her while filming, from somebody named John Steele. Well, she doesn't know John Steele, so she doesn't return that call. But he continues to call, and he leaves several more messages, to which she still does not respond to those. And then one day she gets flowers in her dressing room. Not just some flowers. They just keep coming. Flowers after flowers after flowers until her dressing room's full and she can't even hold them all in there. And on the card is the name John Steele and a phone number. She does admit that this was a boost to her ego because she had just gotten out of that relationship with Lex Barker. That marriage had ended.
Okay. I was wondering if she was still married.
That one's over. Now, I don't know if she was legally divorced yet.
Okay.
But they had split up and were divorcing. John calls her. Finally, she talks to him. And he asks her out, and she declines. She asks him, do I know you? And he's like, no, but he was like a fan. And he is very persistent, and she is very flattered. So he sends her record albums with her favorite music on them. He sends her takeout from her favorite places to eat. And finally, one day shows up at her house, at her door, without calling or anything. And so she, you know, surprised by that, but she lets him in.
Oh, goodness.
Now, to me, I would be annoyed first, but I would also be a little bit like, okay, you're a little maybe cray-cray.
Right. Persistent
but,
there.
Yeah. But she's flattered by it. And so she lets him in. And she likes the fact that he knows, like, what her favorite music and food and stuff is. Now, later on, looking back on that, she realized that his uncanny way of finding out that stuff about her probably should have raised some red flags.
Right. 2022 or 23, he would be considered a stalker.
Stalker. That's exactly right. But he was handsome. He's given her lots of attention, and she starts falling for him because that's her pattern, right? And he starts, like, inserting himself into her life more and more, becoming more of a staple for her. But one day, she is confronted by a friend of hers, and her friend tells her, you know that this man's real name is not John Steele, right? And she's like, oh. No. He says his name is Johnny Stompanato, and he is associated with a very well-known local mobster named Mickey Cohen.
Oh, goodness.
In fact, Johnny was one of Mickey's bodyguards.
Wow. And let me guess, Lana's not going to, she's not going to see those red flags still.
She is shocked to hear that. But in her true Lana fashion, she's already in love with him. Mm. So that's the other thing. When you first fall in love with somebody, we all tend to do this. We all tend to not see any faults.
Right.
And ignore red flags.
We have those rose-colored glasses.
Yes, even if people around you see the red flags and try to tell you, mm-hmm. we tend to ignore those.
Yeah.
So that's what she's doing. She does make some half-hearted attempts after that to call things off. But he's, you know, he's persistent and she's weak. And they do continue to see each other. And she says now at this point she's already becoming a little fearful of him. Because sometimes he would make kind of like joking like threats, like, you're never going to be rid of me. Mm. And you can take that like maybe in a flattering way, like somebody saying, oh, I love you so much, I'll never leave you.
Right.
But she found out later those threats became more and more menacing.
Yeah, more red flags.
Definitely. And then you can see these red flags and you want to say, Lana, stop it. What are you doing?
Right.
Yeah. So it doesn't seem at first like she's really even trying too hard to get away from him. But she finally realizes she's got to go to Europe to make a movie. And she thinks, oh, that'll put some distance between us. And so he wants to go with her, and she does stand her ground and refuse to let him go.
Oh, good.
She says in her mind that was her trying to kind of get rid of him. But poor Lana, after a while, I just want to shake my head here. After a while of being there, she gets lonely and bored. So she calls him. Invites him to come. She gets him a plane ticket and invites him to come.
And invite her to come.
Exactly.
Spend some time with her.
I know. It's so frustrating to just read these details and think, what are you doing? So, of course, he does. He shows up. When he arrives, at first, things are good. But eventually, he gets bored. He starts complaining about not being able to see her because she's working long hours on the set. In addition to that, she doesn't want to be seen with him in public. Because he is a known mobster.
Oh, okay.
And she was always very worried about her public, what the public perceived her to be and what the media was going to write about her. She didn't want any bad publicity. And in this case, she also said she didn't want bad publicity for the movie either.
Okay.
And so she's kind of starting to realize, oh, maybe I made a mistake by, you know, having him come over here. Now, Johnny is becoming jealous and controlling. And so he's mad. He's not with her on the set. And so they start fighting quite a bit while he's there. And this was the first time their relationship became physically violent. So she comes home one day from the set. They get into a really loud argument. And it comes to a head. So she tells him, leave, go home. And then he flat out refuses. He's like, no, I'm not leaving. And so she threatens to call the police on him. And when she does that, he starts choking her. And then her maid has to come to her rescue, and then the maid threatens him. They finally get rid of him for that night. So she's now desperate to get rid of him. A few days after that, she calls, because she's in Europe, she calls Scotland Yard and tells them that he is over there on a false passport under the name John Steele.
Oh, my goodness.
And gets him deported.
Well, good.
And so... when he found that out, he's furious. So he's threatening her. And at this point, he threatens her life, her mother's life, and her daughter's life.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he's furious. But he does get escorted by the authorities onto the plane and sent home. And so that was Lana's part of the story. I actually did read another part of that story that at one point, he was so jealous. At that set of the movie, she was filming the movie called Another Time, Another Place, and her co-star was Sean Connery.
Oh, I love him.
James Bond, yeah. In a fit of jealousy, Johnny storms onto the set with a gun and points it at Sean Connery. And then Sean Connery, and I love this, he takes that gun from him, punches him, and forces him off the set.
Oh,
in true
God.
James Bond fashion, yes. Which I absolutely love. Can't you just picture
awesome.
It?
Yes.
I've always loved Sean Connery, but I just picturing that, I'm like, yeah, that's awesome. But it was rumored after that the mob was looking for Connery for that.
Oh, my God. Okay.
And so he kind of like had to keep a low profile for a bit. So again, just another event in Lana's life that's almost crazy. Like a movie scene. But like you can't even make this stuff up. And write it. It's just like true life, right?
Yes.
So after this, Lana writes Johnny a couple letters trying to kind of get rid of him. But she does say later on, maybe those letters encouraged him more than discouraged him because right. They were sentimental. And even though she was still kind of like professing her love for him, but saying, like,
I love you so much.
Yeah.
But we probably need to. But I love you.
You've got it. That's it. You're exactly right. And so she, yeah, so kind of encouraged him more not to give up. You can see in those letters that eventually got printed that she was cooling off a little bit, but you can also see that she was just like you just did, was kind of like that. So after her filming wraps up in Europe, she decides she needs a vacation. So she goes to Acapulco. I don't know if I'm saying Acapulco. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Acapulco. I don't know.
I mean, I know how to say it. I just can't get my mouth to say it. She's going to go there for 3 months. But goodness gracious, she had told Johnny she was going to do that. So guess what? He shows up.
Surprise, surprise.
That's what I was going to say. I don't know why she's even surprised, but she was surprised that he showed up. I'm like, why would you be surprised? So he's there. He also knew her exact itinerary and all the little details about her trip that she had not shared. So she has no idea how he found that out. And again, that's the whole, can you say stalker here?
Right.
Yeah. So now he's by her side again, and he is adamant he is not leaving. She says she tries really hard to get rid of him at this point, and he basically tells her that they are going to work through this and make that relationship work. He is not taking no for an answer, and he's going to stay right there with her.
Where is her kid during all this?
Not with her. Her kid's either with her mom or with the nanny.
That's frustrating.
It is very frustrating. They have several arguments while they're on this vacation. And she says at this point, she's just trying to wait it out because she doesn't really know what else to do. He is slapping her around quite a bit, asserting more and more control over her. And he's also able to get a gun while he's there. He uses the pretense there are iguanas there, and they were both afraid of those iguanas. So he uses that to get a gun to protect them, quote unquote. But that's, he has it illegally.
I mean, I think we probably saw that coming.
Yeah. And he uses it to threaten and manipulate her constantly. And at one point he tells her, you know, that he's going to shoot her. And she asks him, and then what are you going to do? And he tells her he was going to shoot himself. And we know that that happens frequently. So I don't think he was making an empty threat at all. The day comes when her agent informs her she's been nominated for an Academy Award due to her role in the movie Peyton Place.
Oh.
Yeah. Ironically, this is kind of funny. When I first started reading all this book about Lana, at one point in my mind, I thought, golly, her life reads like a little Peyton Place. I didn't realize that she starred in that movie.
Really?
And see, that's the saying. I know younger listeners won't even know this, but that when you say something's a Peyton Place, that saying just means that there's a... that it looks nice and pretty on the outside, but there's like a lot of sordid sexual stuff going on and hypocrisy and just a bunch of stuff underneath the surface.
That is a lot like her life.
It is. And so it was funny that I had that thought. And then as I read further, I'm like, oh, that's where we get that saying from the movie that she starred in. And her real life was even more so. So I did laugh at myself when I did that. So she goes home because she wants to go to the Academy Awards show. Because she's had that nomination. So she does come home from her vacation. And now she's feeling like she is his captive because he doesn't leave her side. And he assumes he's going to be escorting her to the Academy Awards. But she says, like, no, you're not. I want my mom and my daughter, Cheryl, to go.
Well, good.
Right. She's finally trying to make that a good decision, right? He tries pleading with her. Doesn't work. Then he bullies her. That doesn't work. And then he insists that, well, then you're not going to the after party. Yeah, I mean, like, he's just trying every angle he can. But she does go to the after party. And then when she gets home late with her daughter, she drops her mother off at home. She and Cheryl go to their house. She gets Cheryl to bed. She goes into her bedroom to get ready for bed and turns on the light. And guess who's sitting there?
Oh, my goodness. Johnny.
Yes. Like, how scary would that be?
Yes.
So, I mean, like, he is flat out. Like, right. Yes.
He's stalking her.
Stalking
her. She's in a full-on abusive relationship.
Full-on. And so, you know, they argue. He's mad because she didn't take him and then she didn't come home early. And he tells her, you are never leaving me alone again like this. I will be going with you everywhere.
How does he have time to be in the mob when he's controlling her life like
that? I know. Well, I guess he keeps weird hours. I have no idea. So that fight becomes violent, and he beats her up pretty badly this time, and he's threatening her, and again, threatening her life, her daughter's life, her mother's life. And remember, now her daughter's in the other room and can hear
scary.
This. And she's terrified because, you know, she knows her daughter's asleep. She doesn't want her to hear this argument. She's fearful if her daughter wakes up that Johnny could kill them. She's just trying to placate him to get him to calm down. So that argument finally ends. They go to bed after a really long night. And then the next, you know, within the next few days, her daughter is asking her mom, you know, why are you letting him talk to you like that? And what's going on? And so Lana, her daughter is 14. Right. Lana tells her about all the violence that's been going on. And her daughter says, well, why can't you just call the police? She says, you know, I'm just trying to do this in the safest way. She says she just doesn't really know, you know, what to do. I imagine, and we're all sitting here thinking, why doesn't she just get rid of this guy? She's got agents and business associates. She could probably have him taken care of pretty quickly.
Right. Bodyguards is what I'm thinking.
Right. She's got the money for this stuff. But I imagine any woman who's been in a domestic violence situation kind of mm-hmm. understands the whole, why don't you leave? And it's so much more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I do know that many times when women get the courage to finally leave, they end up dead.
Yeah.
They do end up being killed. That's usually when a domestic violence situation turns into murder. It is because the woman has finally left. And that would definitely be a deterrent to leaving, right? And we know those threats aren't just threats. They're very real. And don't forget, he is a real mobster.
Right.
So he probably can do this and make it even look, you know, he maybe could get away with it.
Yeah.
So while I do question a lot of her life choices, I don't really judge her for not knowing how to get rid of him.
No, I don't either. I think that's why it's important to not ignore the red flags in the beginning.
In the beginning.
Yeah, because it does get more complicated especially, as time goes.
Especially if you have friends who are trying to tell you. Like she did have that friend come to her.
Yeah. Listen to the people around you.
Right. So a week after that incident, Lana, she rents a new home on Bedford Drive. John sticking with her like glue. She just can't shake him. So they go together. They run some errands. They buy some things for the house, some kitchen supplies and utensils and other things. They come home. She had some friends come by for a drink, and they're talking about getting together. And of course, as soon as they leave, Johnny's angry again because she did not include him in the plans. Here we go again. This fight is starting. He's shouting. He's cursing. He's threatening her. Her daughter hears this argument again, hears those threats. She hears him threatening to mess up Lana's face. He says, "You'll never work again." He says he's going to cut her face up. You know, she's scared for her mom. And at one point, I did read that her mom said to her, "I don't know what to do. You're going to have to help me," to her daughter. Wow. Okay. And that's putting a lot on
pressure on a
child.
Yeah,
it really is. So it's all leading up to the happening. This is what Lana and Cheryl have called it for years, the happening. April 4th, 1958, starts out like a normal day. Lana and Johnny running errands together. Evening comes, and Cheryl's home with them as well. Another argument starts, just like always. Johnny's getting out of control. He is drinking. He's following her around, shouting, slamming doors. Lana knows that this is going to be another bad fight. She yells for Cheryl to go to her room and says not to come in there. They're in Lana's bedroom having this fight. She said that she could hear Cheryl at the door because she had given Cheryl a charm bracelet and she could hear that tinkling. So she knew she was still out there. And okay. She's like, "Go away from the door." She's trying to protect her.
Right.
The only way she really knows how.
Yeah.
But Cheryl's not listening. She's at the door saying, "Just let me in." She wants to try to talk to them and calm them down. I can, you know, she's worried about her mom. She's worried he's going to cut her face up. All of those things. At some point, Lana opens the door. Lana had told Johnny to leave and not come back. And he actually was getting his clothes out of the closet. So he had some shirts on a hanger. And when Lana opened the door, Cheryl sees him with those hangers up over his head, those shirts over his shoulder. And it looks like he is getting ready to hit Lana with that. Something. She didn't know it was a hanger. She thought it was some weapon. She thought he was attacking her mom. Cheryl runs in. She thrust her arm out toward Johnny. He jerks suddenly, sucks in his breath, hits the floor. So Lana thinks that Cheryl has punched him in the stomach. She says she never saw a weapon. But what Cheryl had actually done was stabbed Johnny Stompanato with an 8-inch butcher knife.
Oh my goodness.
In order to protect her mother. Yeah. Oh,
that breaks my heart for her. And wow. Okay.
The knife was part of that set that Lana and Johnny had just recently purchased. But he was dead very shortly. Lana immediately sends Cheryl to her room. Cheryl's crying. She goes in her room and calls her dad immediately. Lana calls her mom and says, call the doctor, because she can't remember the doctor's number off the top of her head. Lana's mother calls Dr. John McDonald, and then the police is called.
Okay.
Okay, so the doctor comes. He injects Stompanato with an adrenaline injection directly into his heart. He tells Lana to call the ambulance, but Johnny is not able to be revived, and in fact, he does die within minutes.
Okay. I hate this.
Yeah.
You know, you live violent, you die violent.
Right. The police chief arrives, and at one point, Lana says that she asked him, can I say I did it? Because she doesn't want Cheryl involved in it. And, of course, he says, no, you can't do that. And he says, we're going to have to get to the bottom of this, but we're going to go down to the station to do that. And so Cheryl and her mother are taken down to the police station. They get to ride in their lawyer's limousine. Formal statements are then taken at the police station. And some people claim that on that ride to the police station, it gives them a chance to come up with a story to protect Lana by claiming that Cheryl did it. And some people think that Lana actually really did it.
I wondered that, actually. Yeah.
Now, her daughter does maintain, even as an adult, in her own book that she writes, that she is the one who did it.
Okay.
However, later, Lana does get sued by representatives of John Stompanato's 10-year-old son and the people who are representing him on his behalf. And so we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Okay. I'll tell you how that ends just shortly. But one of the things they do is they try to claim that Lana did it as well. They're wanting to, cast that doubt on her.
Right.
Also, during the hours right after the murder, Johnny's apartment is broken into. Now, Mickey Cohen, the mobster, he claims that the cops broke in it. But interestingly enough, letters from Lana to John somehow find their way into Mickey Cohen's hands. And then those letters, which had been in John's apartment, are leaked to the press.
Oh, my gracious.
Right. And of course, the press is going to print those.
Oh, yeah.
And so the contents of those letters, which we talked about earlier, were professing her love for him, talking about that kind of stuff. That does cast doubt on Lana's story as well with some of the public. And it adds to that whole sensationalness of the story.
Right.
And Mickey Cohen even says to the Herald Examiner, I thought it was fair to show that Johnny wasn't exactly unwelcome company, like Lana said.
Yeah.
And some of those letters do seem to show that. Now, the last two that she wrote him did show that she was kind of cooling toward him and maybe half-heartedly trying to get rid of him. But all the ones leading up to that, kind of did some cast a little doubt there. People are questioning her just the way we did when we were talking earlier. Like, why are you allowing this to go on and on and on? Cheryl ends up being detained and held. The DA makes sure to note that she's not going to get special treatment just because her mother's a famous movie star. And they take her to juvenile hall. Now, at this point, she is just being held as a material witness and not a suspect, although she has already admitted to being the one that stabbed him. Her defense lawyer insists that he can prove the death was justifiable homicide, and he asked the judge to release Cheryl to her grandmother's care. The chief of police, he's ready to go to trial. He says it's clear that Stompanato was killed with a knife, and they have the person who did it. But the DA requests for Cheryl to be detained because he doesn't want her being pressured by the mob or by Lana.
Okay, yeah.
So he feels like it's best for her to stay detained. And the judge agrees for her safety. And so she is actually kept detained until the coroner's inquest. And that coroner's inquest is like a hearing to determine if a crime has been committed. It's not actually a trial. And her lawyer gets Cheryl acquitted from testifying because of all the trauma she's already endured. Because, again, she's 14. But there is one key witness, and that key witness is the other person who actually saw the stabbing.
Oh.
And Lana is getting ready to give her performance of a lifetime.
Okay.
Whatever happens next is on her. Either her daughter is going to walk free, or she is going to be charged with the death of Stompanato based on Lana's testimony. So this inquest, it happens on April 24th. And the murder happened on April 4th. So it's only, you know, approximately
20 days.
Yeah, 3 weeks.
Yeah.
It's going to be broadcast live on CBS and ABC.
Oh, wow.
You can imagine that the public has a really high interest in the case. I mean, it was like, you know how we are about celebrity culture now.
Right.
You know, we all want to know what's going on. I bet you everybody listening to this watched the Amber Heard, Johnny Depp stuff. Because we want to see that stuff. And it was like that then. So the coroner, he shares the autopsy results. And those show that Johnny had been stabbed once in the abdomen. The knife had happened to slice a kidney, hit a vertebrae, twist up, and puncture his aorta.
My goodness.
Yeah. And one account I read said it had pierced his liver as well. And that's why he died so quickly. They said no amount of CPR could have saved him. And now Lana's turn to testify comes. She gives a moment-by-moment recap of the events that transpired. She breaks down a couple times on the stand. Now, it's also interesting to note here that the movie Peyton Place, which is the one she was, just prior to this, voted for an Academy Award.
Yeah.
She didn't win that award, by the way, but she was nominated for that movie. And that was the one right before this big argument happened.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, that movie's box office receipts saw a sharp incline.
Okay.
And what's fascinating is that in that movie, Lana has a very famous scene at the end in which her character is being interrogated in a courtroom. And she's being questioned about the crimes of her daughter's friend who had killed a man.
Oh, my goodness. That is interesting.
It's like real life imitating fiction.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? So after Lana's testimony, the court proceedings continue. Some mysterious guy jumps from the gallery and starts shouting accusations, saying, "This is all a bunch of lies." He says Johnny was a gentleman, and he even accuses Lana and her daughter of both being in love with Johnny, and he claims that jealousy between the mom and the daughter is what instigated the murder.
Oh, wow.
Can this be any more like a movie? I mean, it's like, this doesn't even seem like it's going to happen in real life. You know, he runs out, he's apprehended, nobody hears from him again. Some people think that Mickey Cohen planted him there to do that. Mm-hmm. Just more sensational stuff for the press to write about. So you can just imagine during that day watching these court proceedings, how you would be just like flabbergasted by all the stuff going on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the jury only takes half an hour, little less than half an hour.
Okay.
To deliberate, and they return with a verdict of justifiable homicide.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yes,
I'm so glad.
It is determined that acting out of fear for her and her mother's life, Cheryl Crane was deemed to be justified in stopping Johnny Stompanato's attack on her mother by using deadly force. I do want to point out that was not a unanimous verdict, though.
Really?
But it didn't have to be, because this was not a trial. It was just a coroner's inquest.
Okay.
So the prosecutor could still choose to press charges or not, and he chooses not to.
Okay.
But he does initiate court proceedings to determine if Lana is fit as a mother.
Oh.
And I don't blame him one bit for that either.
I don't either.
I think, okay, that's probably, I mean, that's I fair. See why you would do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Remember when I had mentioned that Lana was sued on behalf of Stompanato's minor son?
Yes.
Okay. From what I could gather from the Press Democrat, dated April 25th, 1958, they were sued for $750,000, Lana and her ex-husband, Steve Crane, the parents of Cheryl.
Okay.
They were sued for $750,000 in a damage lawsuit. And it was to clear Johnny's name. His family is claiming, you know, they're trying to clear his name. Like he's not a bad guy.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay, look, I'm sorry. You're a mobster.
Yeah.
And yeah. So that suit claimed that there was parental negligence in the killing of Johnny, which, I mean, there was parental negligence leading up to that, for sure. Right. Oh, but yeah. That doesn't take away the fact that he brought that on himself.
Right. He damaged his own reputation.
Definitely. According to MSN.com, that suit was settled out of court, but it took 4 years. But 4 years later, that $750,000 suit was settled for $20,000.
Okay.
So they got a little bit, but not a lot.
Well, good.
So on April 25th, which was just 3 weeks after the murder, Cheryl goes to live with her grandmother by order of a judge. And there are several years in which Cheryl struggles, as you can imagine.
I'm sure.
I mean, goodness, what she's been through. For a while, she has a very strained relationship with her mother. But she eventually joins her father in his restaurant business. And that seems to kind of be a new beginning for her and kind of helps her get her life on track. So to wrap this story up, I'm going to add that years later, Cheryl Crane wrote her own book about this happening. And I told you that's what she and her mother referred to that night as. Lana's biography came out in 1982, and then Cheryl's came out a few years later in 1985. It was during this time of writing that book and her and her mom talking a lot through all of that, that she says they were able to make amends in their relationship. And they both have said that they were close in the years after that.
Oh, good.
Now, one other thing that Cheryl includes in her book. Now, I did not get to read her book because I didn't have time to order a copy before I did this. But I did read some excerpts from it online. One other thing that she says in her book that, now Lana doesn't put it in her book, and I'm thinking that's because she was protecting her daughter's privacy.
Okay.
But she says when Lana was married to Lex Barker, remember that was Tarzan?
Yes.
That he repeatedly sexually assaulted her over the span of a few years. Now, I think that explains why she was already getting into trouble and being rebellious and having trouble in her teen years.
Yes.
So she just came out of that situation, and then her mom starts dating this mobster. Like, I don't know, the poor girl.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to read an article for you from the Sacramento Bee, dated April 19, 1958, and I want you to give me your thoughts on it.
Okay.
So this was from, now given what you know, what Cheryl has said in her book about Lex Barker. He gave an interview to a magazine during the time right after the murders. And in that magazine, he, quote, says, "Cheryl has always been a disaster," unquote. He blamed Cheryl for the breakup of his marriage with Lana. He has gone on to say, "Cheryl is tall, strong, self-conscious girl. It is strange that to stab a man of her height, she did not hit his chest, as it should have been natural. It was only at war school that I learned that knife wounds can be inflicted with more strength and more chance of success from below." Now, I will say Cheryl was 5'8". That magazine also quoted him as saying that Cheryl was very strange, two-faced. Then he goes on to say, "My divorce depended on Cheryl. It was the 26th of February, 1957. The girl returned to the house and told a story to her mother. I denied that it was true. But Lana always had one great fault, to believe her daughter first, though knowing that she was a girl full of complexes and accustomed to lie. I tried to show that the story was made out of whole cloth, but Lana didn't want to believe me. She wanted to separate, and the next morning I left the house accepting her decision."
Wow.
Yeah.
He sounds, first of all, he sounds like a jerk.
Yes, he does.
And I believe her. Especially,
I do too.
Since as an adult.
Yeah, you know, I do too.
She went on to say this happened, and I definitely believe her. And you can tell he has some real animosity toward her.
Yep, and I think he's trying to cover himself. She had told her mom and her grandmother about that incident.
Right.
And then that did cause the breakup of the marriage, rightfully so.
Yeah, right.
And I think now that that story was out there, he's afraid it's going to come back to bite him in the butt, and he's going to get caught. And so I think he's doing damage control.
Yes.
And when this murder happens, that's his opportunity to throw her under the bus.
Yep.
That's what it sounds like to me.
It does. Me too. Yeah, to destroy her credibility or
He wants to point out that she's a liar.
Right. Yeah.
And he also makes it sound like she, when she stabbed Stompanato, that she deliberately planned how she was going to do it. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's something. I'm never watching Tarzan again.
I know, right? That's exactly right. I'm like, ugh. But I do believe her. And yeah. I think, you know, given that that had just happened and then Stompanato, this poor girl, actually, I admire her courage because she did what her mother could not do.
Right.
Which was stand up to Johnny and protect herself.
Yeah. I have a 14-year-old. I just can't imagine her being put in the, you know, in a situation to where she would have to do something like that, because that, you know, that's going to stick with her the rest of her life. It's not easy to kill a person.
Right. And she did carry that. Mm-hmm. I also have a 14-year-old. And so we look at that and we think, we can't even imagine our children having to go through that.
No.
You know, there were some people who criticized saying that Lana had to have done it because Cheryl was too young. She couldn't have done that. But I think she absolutely could.
Oh, yeah.
I think she was in protective mode of her mom. Just because somebody is 14 does not mean they cannot, you know, stand up and have the courage to protect somebody else. I think there are people who are, like, for instance, I'm a rule follower. Okay. You know, if somebody tells me to do something, I'm going to do it. I'm a rule follower. But sometimes we need people who are not rule followers, who mm-hmm. are going to stand up no matter what. And so just a personal story from my own life, when I was about 11 and my two of my sisters were, I think, approximately 14 and 17.
Okay.
My mom's husband at the time, my mom was trying to leave him. It was one of those situations. He was controlling. He was jealous. He was crazy. She was trying to leave and could not do it. So in a fit of manipulation, he shot himself.
Oh my goodness.
And he did not really want to kill himself. Like if he had wanted to, he could have killed himself and he didn't.
Yeah, right.
He made it. He actually did that while my oldest sister was at home. She was the only one there. She had to go to the neighbors and call the ambulance. She was 17. Well, so of course what happens, my mom takes him back. He comes home from the hospital. And so he's got a wound where it went into his chest and exited out of his back. So on his back, he has a wound and it's stitched up.
Okay.
And so, I don't know, maybe within a week or two, he's taking his pain meds and drinking. And he goes crazy one night. He just loses it one night. Me and my sister, we wake up to him yelling, screaming, cursing in the other room, calling my mom all kinds of horrible things. My 14-year-old sister jumps out of bed, goes in there. He has my mom and my 17-year-old sister on the bed choking them. And they cannot get up because he was out of his mind crazy. And you know how people have strength when they're like that?
Oh, yeah.
He was on adrenaline and they could not get up. He was choking them both. My 14-year-old sister punches him in the back, right in that wound.
Good.
Where that bullet had come out, and he just like, groans, rolls over on the bed off of my mom and my sister. They get up, but he's looking for his.
She saved them.
She did. And thankfully, it's because she was, you know, she had the courage at that age to do that. Also, he was looking for his guns during this time. My oldest sister had thrown those guns underneath our trailer, so he couldn't find them. And so they were trying to placate him and calm him down. My oldest sister comes and tells us, go get in the car and lock the door until we get out there. My 14-year-old sister, who's not a rule follower, she doesn't do that. I do that. I go get in the car and lock the door because that's what I was told to do. But my 14-year-old sister runs across to the neighbor's house and tells them to call the cops. And because we didn't even have a phone. We didn't have a phone back then. So she runs across to call the cops. Nobody knows where I'm at because I did what I was told and they forgot. But my oldest sister finally came and got me out of the car. But I want you to know, while I'm sitting in that car in the back seat, crouched down, my mom's husband was chasing her around that car with an 8-inch blade, switchblade knife. And I'm sitting there watching it from the car, terrified, terrified. But had it not been for the actions of both of my sisters, who were just teenagers, that I feel like would have ended very badly.
Yes.
My mom probably would have been killed. And so I think it's bogus for people to say, oh, that 14-year-old couldn't have done that. She's covering for her mom. She was only 14. Yeah, she could have done that. And she obviously had more courage than her mom had.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
So
that's a good.
Sorry to get off on that little tangent. No,
but that's a good example. And I do think when you're protecting, I come from a single, my mom was single too.
Yeah.
And so I know we were very protective of our mother.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was wild. I got in trouble all the time and I was terrible, but I didn't want anybody hurting
your
mom. Yeah.
That's right.
I feel like I could have killed somebody.
Yeah. Because that's your mom.
Right.
So again, not that I was trying to make that about me or anything, but while I was reading this story, that just kept coming to my mind like over and over again. So I wasn't sure if I was going to share it or not.
No, that was a good story.
Well, if you would like to read Cheryl Crane's own version of those events, the title of her book is Detour, A Hollywood Tragedy, My Life with Lana Turner, My Mother. That's a long title. After all was said and done, Lana went on to make many more movies. She also went on to marry 3 more times.
Oh, my goodness.
Each of
Lana,
those.
Come on.
I know. Each of those ending in divorce. She never found the one, the marriage that would last forever. But she did make amends with her daughter for that dysfunctional childhood that she had made her endure. So this story, you know, it doesn't have a happy ending. I mean, it was bound to not have a happy ending, but it did have a right ending because most of the time I don't want to put so much emphasis on a murderer that the victims lose their voice.
Right.
But in this case, I don't feel like the murdered person was, I mean, he's not the victim here.
No, he wasn't.
I think Cheryl and Lana both are victims here, Cheryl the most.
Mm-hmm.
And so had they charged her with that, that would have been another crime in itself. I'm so grateful that it was justifiable homicide, and I'm so glad that that's how it was ruled.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
That's really the end of our story.
Now, those were some hard times.
Yes, they were.
Well, that brings us to the end of another episode of Hard Times and True Crime. And as always, we'd like to let you know how much we appreciate your listener support. It's a bunch. And I'd like to remind you to leave us a 5-star rating on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you stream your podcasts. And if you're on Apple, go ahead and leave us a quick review. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And if you loved what you heard, and let's be honest, we both know you did. Go ahead and tell everybody you know, and a couple people you don't, to check out Hard Times and True Crimes. Until next time, goodbye.